Here we go. Good day from Wall Street. This is Jack Marks for Wall Street Reporter. And today I am speaking with Brent Willis. He is the CEO of New Age Beverage Corp. Stock symbol on NASDAQ is BNEV. Brent, welcome.
Hey Jack, how are you?
Excellent. So I know you're at the airport, so there might be a little bit noise in case anybody who's listening is curious. New Age right now is one of the world's fastest growing companies in the beverage industry. It looks like you guys started with just from a few million dollars in sales 3 years ago. Right now, you're on track to generate over 300 million in sales this year. So can you start off by, telling our audience like how the company got started and maybe, a quick snapshot of the history and how you got to where you are at, today?
Yeah, well, I'd say, it all comes down to hard work, and it never seems to end. But, we had a vision to create a niche within the beverage industry because we knew, number one, fundamentally, consumers were changing around the world. Number two, retailers were having to change because 80% of their traditional business, whether it's processed food, beer, tobacco, whatever, was declining. And three, the legacy leaders in this $1 trillion non-alcoholic beverage sector were really distracted to try to defend the Cokes and the Pepsis and their legacy leaders. So when you did the math, you said, hey, there's a real opportunity here. And we just created our roadmap on how to win within that space, which came from A, having brands within the growth sectors of the industry and no exposure to the declining segments of the industry, but then building the executional capabilities, the distribution platform, and sources of competitive advantage. So, we actually laid out the entire roadmap on how to get from point A to point B. And point B, by the way, has something with a B attached to it, not a million or 2 million in revenue like when we started 2.5 years ago. So getting to point B with a B attached to it, it's not linear, but we laid out that entire roadmap on how to get there, and we just executed what we said we were going to execute. And even though, like you said, Jack, we've gone from 2 million to 320 plus million, 340 million now in a little bit more than 2.5 years, it's not success. It's just hitting the interim milestones. We didn't come here to build a $5 stock or a $10 stock or a small competitor in the beverage industry. We came here to, frankly, make a difference for consumers with healthy products, number one. But number two, create incredible wealth for shareholders, of which every single employee in the company is a shareholder. And I've been associated with some other big enterprises, and I've never seen a wealth creation kind of opportunity like this one. So we're just excited to be able to drive it and execute it for the benefit of A, all the employees, but also B, every single one of our valued shareholders.
Now, Brent, you mentioned from point A to point B, B with a billion. How many B's are going to be there?
Well, 1B would be a good start, right? So you can't always just say, look, here's the end goal, because you always move the goalposts, especially as a CEO. You move the goalposts, which is irritating for everybody on our team, but that's one of my jobs, right? So always keep moving that goalpost. But, hitting the first B is an interim milestone. But when you look at this sector, the profits really start to accrue once you get above $1 billion in scale. But to be one of the top 10 beverage companies in the industry, we need to be north of $5 billion. To be one of the top 30 companies in the industry, or top 20 companies, you need to be north of $1 billion. And today we're the 40th largest non-alcoholic company in the world, beverage company in the world. So, next target. It's not about size, honestly, Jack. It is about having, living our purpose and having the scale to be able to do more. And, that's why we created this company, to make a difference for consumers with healthy alternatives. And, frankly, we get pissed off when our competitors launch their newest product that has 69 grams of sugar in it, right? So it's just unconscionable, and we think they've lost the plot. So we want to make a difference with for consumers that that don't have those kinds of ingredients in it.
So Brent, you start off by saying that you intentionally wanted to start focusing only on the growth sectors. So looking at some of your product lines, I mean, they're really in kind of all the hot areas. So can you give us an overview of the product of the current product line, and what are some of the kind of most exciting areas that you see going forward?
Well, one of the fastest growing areas of the beverage industry worldwide is the kombucha category, and it is really becoming mainstream. The category is growing at about 35%, and we're leading that category growth. And it's becoming a relevant category in terms of size. And we have a brand called Bucha Live Kombucha in that segment that's got 2 billion probiotics, just like all the other kombuchas. The only difference between ours is, number one, it's shelf-stable. Number two, it has 12 months of shelf life, unlike everybody else that has 90 days. And number three, ours doesn't have the acquired taste of many of the other kind of vinegar tasting kombuchas, because we have a proprietary production process that leads to that competitive advantage. So that's one category, and we're excited about that. We own the license rights to the Marley franchise globally. And, if you look at that brand, it's got 72 million Facebook followers, right? That's twice what Starbucks has, for example. So
The Marley brand, you have 72 million followers.
72 million, wow. Facebook followers, right? So it's really relevant across all demographics, all target audiences. So that brand for us grew 78% this year, this last year in volume terms. So it is really resonating with consumers. And those are two of the attractive pieces. We also own Zing Tea. And that is the number one ranked tasting tea in all of North America. So it beat out 250 other brands. And our last brand is Coco Libre. So Coco Libre competes in the coconut water segment. It's an elegant, beautiful product made from young coastal coconuts in the southern coast of Vietnam. And those, and we came up with the first sparkling coconut water, zero added sugar, 30 total calories, and just a very elegant, delicate, beautiful product. And those, I would say, are our four core franchises. And then on Monday, we just completed another acquisition that brought in the license or distribution rights to Nestea. And Nestea is being reformulated to be organic and aseptically produced. And so it's a complete relaunch of that product. But it's the same license that Coke used to have, right? Yeah, when I used to be president for Coke for about half of Latin America. And now we have that same opportunity with that brand. And then we've also got Volvic, which is the second largest water brand in the world, from Danone, and then Evian in the natural channel. So, we've just added some globally recognized brands, again, in growth segments to our portfolio that really position us as the preeminent one-stop shop for healthy beverages for really retailers of all types.
Now, can you talk about the distribution and marketing model? You have kind of a unique strategy, this omni-channel approach, as you call it. So in terms of, maybe if you can talk about how it differentiates from, traditional beverage industry models, and, what kind of competitive advantage you see this giving the company?
Well, I kind of equate our go-to-market strategy equivalent to the West Point football team. Look, if you're going to play in Division I football and you've got guards that are Army guys and they're going to, weigh 250 pounds and you have to compete against Oklahoma and Alabama, how do you win? Well, the answer for those guys is you run the triple option and you do it and you execute it flawlessly. So we have to run our equivalent of that, because if we just played in traditional retail up against Coke and Pepsi, where they've got a 50-year head start and 1,000 times our scale, you know, we're not going to be very successful. So we have to win on our terms, on our field, in our own way. And one of those ways is through an omni-channel approach. And our view is, look, consumers, especially millennials, you know, how do they buy products, Jack? I mean, they want to, A, buy it off their mobile phone, right? And it's, this is 50% of the global consumer base. They buy it off their mobile phone. They want it delivered to their home. And they don't need intake media like they used to. I remember when I was at InBev, my marketing budget alone was 3.3 billion euros a year. And we spent it. But we did have virtually no social and digital. And that was, you know, literally 10 years ago. Now, you know, consumers don't respond to TV advertising like they used to. So, you know, it's all social, Instagram feeds, micro-influencers, and those kinds of things. So, you know, we are very fortunate in that we have the system around the world with access to 60 markets and an infrastructure in 60 markets that does home delivery, uses micro-influencers, friends, and family, and people buy stuff off their mobile phones. So people would be surprised, but, you know, we have a one of the segments of our business is an e-commerce business. So we sell $171 million of auto ship, direct auto ship business via our e-commerce business, direct to consumer homes. So if you think about that as a potential source of competitive advantage and an equivalent of playing your own game and playing to win, you know, that's our approach. But, you know, I would say we are indifferent about, and I really do mean on the indifference curve of how we get our products. We want to put our products and our brands in consumers' hands within an arm's or a click's reach of desire. So whatever it takes to do that as efficiently as possible, we're going to do.
So maybe you could talk a bit about the direct-to-consumer side of the business, because that seems like a very interesting part of the business from, was it Morinda?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, just think about it from a cash flow management standpoint. Typical, you know, return on your cash invested is, look, you buy a product, you get it produced, you put it in distribution, you sell it to the retailer, they get it onto the shelves, and by the time you get your money, from the time you've made the product, it's probably 120 days. With that direct-to-consumer system, I produce a product, I ship it out, I charge the customer for it, and I get paid in 3 days. So it's T plus three cash management versus T plus 120. It's very unique in that respect. And we've probably got about 150,000 independent distributors, but a total of 300,000 independent product consultants, distributors, and customers around the world that we ship product to every single month. So, you know, our challenge is to just increase that base, number one. But number two, bring new products through that system and other systems. And for example, we just launched it. One of our products called Noni Plus Collagen. So a collagen-based beverage. We just launched it in China this last month, and in the first month of sales, it sold more than $2 million of revenue in just that one market alone. So, you know, we've got this funnel, we got this execution system, and as we drive more and more of our portfolio through, not just our existing key brands, not just the historic brands that we've had in the direct-to-consumer system, but new brands, whether it's brands and products from our health sciences division, CBD, or other things, we've got this plethora of ammunition just waiting to be unleashed through this execution system we've now built, spanning 60 geographies worldwide.
So, you know, can you kind of give some examples of like how you see the synergies between the, you know, the direct to consumer and sort of your more traditional retail distribution? I think in one of your news releases, you covered some of that. So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, the easiest and first synergy is first on the cost side. So we get the cost synergies because we've structured the company with shared services across finance, legal, IT, human resources, and operations. So we gain the synergies there, whether it's in scale and production, it's leverage in procurement, it's leverage in shipping, and I think just in integrating our shipping and doing bigger contracts, we've just identified about $1.5 million in shipping efficiencies. So there's a whole range of synergies on the cost side. On the revenue side, for example, we've taken our new age brands, Marley Bucha, Zing, and Coco Libre, and we're registering those in 40 countries around the world. So there's a huge revenue synergy there. That's kind of number two. Number three, the first product we collectively launched through that direct-to-consumer system was CBD creams, lotions, and topicals. So we were able to launch that because we're in the creams business and we're in that topicals business. We had the manufacturing capability, and that was the first product we launched. And as a result of that, we launched on the 25th of April. We had our best month in 10 years in the United States. And we're just methodically rolling that around the world. So, you know, we're very methodical in 3G in our approach for capturing costs and revenue synergies. But I think we communicated that there's about $7 million of costs and revenue synergies that we find, and we're experiencing the opportunity for significantly more than that, just from that latest acquisition. But it's our approach for every acquisition that we've done, because that's where the real value is in capturing the costs and revenue synergies. And we are very methodical and 3G-like in that approach and how we do it.
But I think in with the topicals, from what I understand, you have sort of the regular version that's in retail distribution, and you have like premium versions that are in the direct to consumer. Are you going to be doing that with other brands?
Maybe. But, you know, it was our first foray to basically take similar products and have them in dual, historically different channels of distribution, right? So there is a premium version that you can only get access through from our independent product distributors, but then also we have both a private label version and a regular quality version. So it's the difference between a BMW and a Jetta. So, you know, we've got the Jetta version that we provide in traditional retail. But in that way, we've protected our loyal independent product consultants with the most premium product. And let me tell you, we have all of our doctors and all of our scientists behind it that have been studying CBD for 3 or 4 years, way before it was in vogue. And we brought that science to bear to deliver what we believe is the most efficacious CBD creams, topicals, and lotions in the industry.
So, you know, let's talk a bit more about CBD. I mean, this is like, you know, one of the most talked about, hottest area in the market right now. What are you doing in terms of beverages? You mentioned topicals. Like, what's your kind of CBD strategy, if you will?
Well, I think we should be bigger picture here and abundantly clear in terms of this opportunity. And we do not want to win in Salem, Oregon, for example. We want to win globally. And we're in a position to be able to do that. So I think in weeks, you'll be hearing more news from us about what we're doing in international markets. But the opportunity in beverages in Japan, Mexico, UK, Ireland, Central Europe, Hungary, Uruguay, and other places, as these jurisdictions open and as the regulatory environment allows, we want to be first in each one of those places. And we're lucky we have the Marley brand, which is highly relevant in that space. And we also have our health sciences and enhanced CBD brand for different channels that we're launching in all those markets. So we want to win in Hong Kong. We want to win in Japan. We want to win in China. We want to win in Taiwan. We want to win in Thailand. In each one of these places, and some of these places in Southeast Asia have 70, 80 million, 100 million people growing like crazy. I was going to say growing like a weed, but it would just be inappropriate. And in the United States, it will happen. And it will happen in food and beverages. And even though it's a little bit complicated with the FDA today because it's ambiguous and unclear, the direction is not ambiguous and the direction is not unclear. So as the market opens up and it becomes clear in the United States, we expect to dominate in the United States also, which is why we're having, you know, behind the scenes conversations at the very senior levels with the largest retailers in the world. And we're the only ones that are having those conversations according to them, because we've got the expertise and we got the insight, and we're taking a very medical, methodical, and responsible industry approach to everything that we're doing, and working extremely close with them. So our strategy is to win the world and to win in each market as soon as each market is ready from a regulatory standpoint.
So which markets are you in right now? Because, you know, through the recent acquisitions, I mean, you're in some very interesting areas. Like, can you talk about which markets you're in globally and, you know, some of your, you know, retail distribution points?
Yeah, so just in the United States alone, across the beverage portfolio, this is not including, not doesn't include CBD, we're in about 300,000 traditional retail points of distribution. In our direct store door distribution part of our business, that division is about 45 million, and that is in about 6,000 outlets. We have about 300,000 distributors, and you could think of each one of those as a specific point of distribution in our direct-to-consumer business. And on the e-commerce business, we have a consumer database of about 1 million consumers, and as I said, $171 billion of annual revenue through that system, and that probably encompasses about 150,000 active subscribers. So, you know, our goal is to, well, essentially double, triple every one of these businesses, but different businesses have different vectors for growth, and we're excited, frankly, about all of them. You know, in particular, I would say the e-commerce business, and how we're doing and how we're building those subscribers around the world. But, you know, first you got to have the brands, and you have to have the brands right. We think we've got the right portfolio, and we've just augmented that with the acquisition of Brands Within Reach. And then you got to build that distribution system. And we think we've got a very unique omni-channel distribution system with global reach. So now it's, and we have the financial strength and flexibility. You know, this is a company that's got even though it's only, you know, a little bit north of $300 million, you know, we have $110 billion of cash on the balance sheet and no debt. So I don't know any other small cap company in the world that has that financial strength and flexibility, and that gives us the wherewithal to really be able to invest in the businesses and develop sustainable competitive advantage versus our enemies.
Now, how close are you to break even? Like, will you be reporting positive earnings?
Well, we've guided to $15 million in EBITDA for this year. This last quarter, we did $11.4 million in free cash flow in the first quarter of the year. But as you get more scale and as we integrate these businesses, then, you know, we expect to deliver more and more profit. So it's just a process to deliver that. So, you know, this year I expect us to do at a minimum of $15 million in EBITDA. So I would say all of that's moving in the right direction. Looking back at all the Q's and the K's as you're building the company, you're not in that position, just like Amazon hasn't been in that position for 20 years. But, you know, this is a beverage business and it's a small cap business, and you don't have the full runway that some of these other guys have had to build their business without having to generate profits. So, you know, I expect as we go forward this year that we'll have increasingly profitable quarters as a percent of net sales. And as I mentioned, our guidance for the year is $15 million in EBITDA. And, you know, of course, we hope to do better, but certain things have to go right for us to for that to go better.
Okay. Brent, can you talk about your M&A strategy going forward? Like, what are your, criteria for transactions going forward?
The average multiple in this industry over the past 2.5 years is about 2.4 times revenue. That's the average multiple. Our most recent acquisition was about 0.3 times revenue that we completed on Friday. And on average, I'd say we've been buying at less than 0.5 times revenue. Now, that means that there's some work to do to turn around these businesses and brands and reposition them. But we've been successful in doing that so far. So I would say, when you look at our roadmap, which is public information, we are really in the dialogues with in trying to determine how to effectuate strategic alliances on distribution and global reach and expansion. So we're in the middle of those things now. We don't really need more brands in the portfolio. We have the right access to growth in terms of the segments, and I believe we have a very good brand portfolio that we've just strengthened. So if a fantastic brand comes along at the right value, we'd consider it. But it all comes down to revenue synergies and cost synergies. And anybody that tells you we're buying for strategic reasons, you ought to run from those kinds of companies. Yeah, of course, you have to buy for strategic reasons, but the only way you pay for that strategy is through capturing of revenue and cost synergies that lead to value for shareholders.
So, you mentioned the 100 million plus in cash that you have right now. What are your plans for deploying that capital over the next 12, 18 months?
Well, one way to look at it is just because, we're in all these countries around the world, it takes about $60 to $70 million of working capital just for inventory and product and running the business. So put another way, you really have got, less than 40 million, which is not a lot given our intentions for the growth of the company. So we're going to be extremely miserly about deploying any of that capital. But, we've got some brand building to do. We've got some new markets to penetrate. One of the key jobs of a senior leadership team, and especially the CEO, is human and financial resource allocation towards those fundamental pillars of your strategy that are going to make a real difference. So, and if you don't do that, you're not living your strategy. You're just kind of swimming with the tide. So, we have those strategic choices we've made on which we're allocating disproportionate both human and financial resources to make that difference. And those are principally centered around what we believe are our future sources of sustainable competitive advantage. So, those things are in process, but I kind of don't want to give away what we're spending the money on because I would be giving away too much information as it relates to the strategy.
Okay. Brent, can you tell us about, your background and also some of the other key members of the team?
Sure. If I look at our CFO, he's been a public company chief financial officer for five or six different companies and has effectuated very attractive exits for a number of those. And our chief legal counsel came from Mirinda. Our head of operations also came from the Mirinda acquisition, and these guys are just world-class executives on that side of the business. And then running the business units, we've got Josh Hillegas that came in from the Zing Tea acquisition, and he's just continued to move up, and he's grown that business for 10 years consecutively. We've got a guy by the name of Olivier Sonos, who is a senior executive at Danone before. And he just came in. He was the founder of BWR, and he's now going to be president of our brands division in the U.S. and another key executive. So, on the management team side, I think the guys are great. And of course, I was a Nuki at West Point and then served the country for a number of years. I got to then start at Kraft in marketing. I got to launch Kraft into China, which was fascinating in the early 90s. Then became president for Coke for about half of Latin America. and then took over a small little beer company in Belgium. But, you know, as a Westmont guy, we're kind of into global domination. I'm no different. And I did business school at Chicago. So we kind of figured out the economics of the beer industry. And we went from essentially very small after 660 years of nobody ever hearing about the company. 3 years later, we're the world's largest beer company and north of $40 billion in scale. And that was before we acquired Anheuser-Busch. So it was a real success story to create InBev. And I actually named the company because I wanted to be the in beverage company, the cool beverage company. So that's really where it came from. So,
oh, that's interesting.
It was fascinating experience, right? So, and then after that, when one of the Brazilians got the top job, and it wasn't me, and he was better and he was smarter and he was Brazilian, and he was Stanford and McKinsey, and I was just West Point in Chicago, so it didn't count. But he got the top job. I probably left kind of 9 months after that, and basically started my own private equity portfolio, and then just decided to extricate myself from that and joined and started really this company from an idea a little bit more than 2.5 years ago. It'll be exactly 3 years in on the 1st of July.
Brent, you know, what's your vision for New Age Beverage over the next, let's call it 2-3 years?
Well, we have our strat plan coming up with our board in Japan on the 1st and 2nd of the month. So we are evolving that strategy. But it's simple. You know, we're going to live our purpose to make a difference for consumers around the planet with healthy alternatives. And we're not just going to provide them products. We're going to intend to inspire them to live healthy with all the content and engagement from a community standpoint. So that is the living, breathing ideal of the and driving force of the company. Now, if you have and stay true to that ideal and flawlessly execute your business plan, you're going to drive tremendous wealth for shareholders and do the right thing at the same time. So as I mentioned, we want to get to something with a B attached to it. We've got the specific roadmap and growth vectors defined on how to get from point A to, or is now point C to point D. We are just going to continue to drive that and implement it. We've got all the fundamentals, Jack, that we need to get there. We got the brand portfolio. We have the financial flexibility. We have the intellectual property. We've got this omni-channel distribution system. And we have the organizational capabilities, which I define as the people, the processes, the systems, the information, and the environment and culture to be successful. And ultimately, success only comes down to two things, and that's the quality of your people and the strength of your culture. And I love that aspect about our company. It's not perfect, and you're always building the culture. But, you know, this is a winning, metric-driven, performance-oriented culture, and compensation systems are aligned to propagating that culture. But I love our company. I love our potential. I love what it represents for shareholders. I love the fact that we've already driven 3,000% growth for our shareholders heretofore, but we're just getting started, man.
So, you know, Brent, do you think the stock or the business is really understood by investors? And if not, like, what is it that they're missing?
Well, when you ask the question on the stock, I say any CEO that focuses on a stock price is not a company or a CEO that I'll invest in. So I focus on driving the fundamentals and long-term value for shareholders, and that ultimately accrues to stock price. So we don't focus on the stock price. We don't look at it short-term. And as I said, we didn't come here to build a $5 stock or $10 stock or even a $20 stock. We focus on those fundamentals and what we have to do to win. That being said, I know that most, because it's such a new story and new company, that most institutional investors don't even know about this stock, that it's kind of got the stability and strength of a bulge bracket company, but all of the growth vectors is a small cap or even a micro cap. So it is very different in terms of its risk profile, but also its growth potential. But you know, we only trade at kind of 1.3, 1.2 times sales versus the average of my peer group, just the average, and we're way outperforming them. The average is 4.8 times sales. So we're already, you know, kind of, you know, undervalued by a third, but, you know, I'm relaxed about it because as we put runs on the board, as we deliver the financials, as we execute against our strategy, investors will start to discover it, and we'll be fine with that. But we're here for the long term and driving long term sustainable value for our shareholders, not some some short term bump or growth in the stock.
Brent, my final question, and it relates to the stock again, though, is in your opinion, what would you say the top three reasons that investors, you know, institutions should consider New Age Beverage today?
That's a great question, Jack. I think it, you know, sometimes for these smaller you know, institutions are investing in small cap companies. They think it's all about the people, and they say sometimes it's about the jockey. I couldn't disagree more. You have to have that. It's a cost of entry, and you have to have quality management team and board above reproach, and we have that, and a continuing strengthening organization, team, and management. And that's one thing we have, and continuing strengthening culture. So, you know, that's one kind of linchpin for success. But even the best of management teams in declining sectors or without the right fundamentals or without the right disruptive play aren't going to be successful. So the second thing that I would say that is another reason to believe is we've got an increasingly good, and we just strengthened that again on Monday, healthy brand portfolio. And that is a global trend. It's not a U.S. trend. And we are just driving that disruptive plays that are really taking advantage of consumers shifting away from carbonated soft drinks and sports drinks and juices and those kinds of things. So that's the second reason. We've got the right fundamentals on the brands. And the third thing is we got the execution system. So, and that execution system is supported by the financial flexibility. So when you have those pieces together, it is just about executing of your plan and holding people accountable to execution. So, you know, people don't understand that yet. They will, as we continue to execute over time, and those investors that are getting in now and have gotten in, have benefited already, and we'll get the lion's share of the benefit going forward. So we love the company. We love the people. We love the opportunity. And you can probably tell, I've never been more excited about an opportunity in my life as the opportunity that I see with just abundant clarity here. So I feel fortunate to be part of it and humbled to be part of it. And we're going to do what we have to do to be successful.
Brent, on that note, I want to thank you, and we look forward to following the New Age Beverage story in the months ahead.
Thank you so much, Jack. Appreciate it.